Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. I'm joined now by Ramtin Bashi for our second installment of the new weekly series featuring world media in English, citizen journalism from around the world in English translations. You can find out more information at worldmediainenglish.org. Hello, welcome, Ramtin.
Hi, Jesse, and hello to our listeners. Before I begin in my description in our last program of how we are going to use our time in the program, I should have mentioned that we will start with a roundup of the week's major news, and then we will talk about our ideas for or actual work on reports for world media in English. About a roundup of international news, obviously it can be made up of a very small selection from among many, many important events and situations that go on in the world. And in keeping with our main philosophy, which is based on citizen journalists reporting and commenting on our about what goes on in their native countries, our roundups may include more about the country where the citizen journalist is from. But at the same time, we will try to look everywhere and bring out the stories that matter because of human rights and environments. Now, for my roundup today, mostly what I have for today is about my native country, Iran. People must know about the morality police by now and the fact that they had largely disappeared from the streets after the uprisings of last year. Well, it became headlines in international news this week that they are coming back. The international headlines said that the government is sending them back on the streets, but there were some important facts and context that didn't get translated.
I do have a question.
Sure.
And, you know, you say people must know about the morality police, and many of our listeners probably do, but many might not. So
okay.
Can you just give a quick
sure.
couple sentence rundown of what you mean when you say the morality police?
Sure. Well, administratively, it's just part of the country's police force. And over there, the police force, there is only one police force for the whole country. There is no divisions or anything. And so it's administratively, it's been given to them. But really, it came out of the first years of the revolution. What happened is that when the Ayatollah, who had become the leader of the revolution, first of all, as people, and rightly so, mentioned, he wasn't revealing all his intentions at the beginning. Like, he was saying that we are going to give you democracy. Our democracy will be better than France's democracy. We are going to make utilities free, like, you know, water, electricity, and that kind of thing. But and on those kinds of arguments, he put on a referendum, and the referendum was a kind of a yes or no referendum. You would either say yes or no to the establishment of Islamic Republic. And the Islamic Republic that the people voted for at that point was not the Islamic Republic that was coming. And so when this vote came in and the Islamic Republic was established, well, if you are a clergyman, you do have, you know, influence in the hearts of people because they have religious beliefs. And then you have armed people who are going to, you know, suppress people, arrest people, and so on. Then you're going to pretty much do what you want to do, you know. And so this whole hijab thing was one of the first, you know, requirements that he put on people to make it mandatory. And ironically, even to this day, the actual requirements of what is a proper hijab or what is not a proper hijab is not defined in law. Like, there is no lawyer that can tell you what is actually proper hijab or what is not. It's just their own judgment, you know, on the street. And so to make the story short, they made it a law. They said that women have to be covered with their heads, and that means no hair showing. And this was the grand Ayatollah, the leader of the revolution, who was saying that. And therefore, not only the people that believed in him, but also the people that took orders from him and really got their livelihood from him in terms of the armed forces and everybody else, they were going to enforce it. But it became some kind of a forced thing that people never really accepted. And some people do. The statistics go that 20%, a maximum of 20%. There is all kinds of, you know, what do you call it? If I can remember the word in English, it's polls taken, you know, polls taken from people, you know, to make estimations of what people think and what their beliefs are. Of course, the regime over there claims the majority of people want it, but any observer you talk about will tell you that this is not a regime that tells the truth. Other polls that are more, you know, reliable tell you that 80% of the people don't actually believe in the ideology of this regime, only 20%. Although these polls usually come from outside of the country, which is like more from the diaspora, people that don't like the regime, that's true. But these polls are also scientific. It's, you know, university professors in Europe that do it. And they do it by scientific methods, and they take large samples. And if you're Iranian, you actually don't need any polls. You know, you just know everybody around you, like the whole middle class of the people. And even if you are someone who lives in big cities like Vancouver, Toronto, Los Angeles, have you ever seen an Iranian who is going to say that this regime is right? Never. You know, you can talk to anybody, you know. I think I'm going making it a very long answer to your question, but to make the answer shorter, it became like an obligatory thing that they have been forcing on people, and since then, like, three generations have passed, and the kids that are you know, in their 20s right now, this is even like completely out of this world to them, you know. Mm-hmm. it doesn't make any sense, because these are the same kids, you know, that listen to the same music as you. You know, they basically grow up in the same world as anybody else, you know.
Mm-hmm. They participate in global culture.
In global culture, absolutely. And so, but still, that's 20% who live in their kind of their own bubble. You know, this is like in any country, you have bubbles, right? Like, mm-hmm. Even in Canada, you have like neo-fascist people. You know, if you talk to them, they're going to say, well, I'm going to kick out all the, you know, brown people, you know. And these people really live in a bubble of their own, right? They don't have any contact. They don't have exposure to the outside world. And so the people that really run this regime are these sorts of people. They live in a bubble, really. And they have very little understanding of the world outside. And of course, there is that aspect of it that that whole uprising came out of resentment of the previous regime, the Pahlavi regime, was sort of propped up by the West and helped by the West, and that is the only thing that even gave them, you know, that legitimacy to begin with. And these people that live in these bubbles are still living in that era, you know. Mm-hmm. Western imperialism, we are standing up to them, and therefore they don't like us, they want to crush us, you know. But the world has changed a lot. There is no Western imperialism anymore. If there is any Western imperialism, the worst part is Eastern imperialism now, you know. And so we're living in a very different world, you know. Right now, I'm somebody from that country, and you are from, you know, a white person, and we are having this conversation, and you are not going to, you know, abuse me or anything like that, you know. So the world has changed a lot, but these people that live in these bubbles, they haven't changed. And these are the people that work for these, you know, divisions of the morality police and so on. So again, it's the way it works is actually it's like these vans are made of a policeman who is actually like a member of the police force. And somebody like a lady who is doing this on a volunteer basis too. And in Islam, there is something called commanding to good and negating of bad, which means that you order people or you request people to do good and request them not to do bad. And this is like a religious duty, you know, that kind of thing. And so all these things combine that right now you have in this country, which is very much a modern country living in the global culture that is going ahead with all this modernization. You have this little bubble that is still keeping this country and its people hostage, really, and enforcing their ideology on them. And what makes this possible is really geopolitics, because right now it's really big powers on the other side, like China and Russia, that are kind of keeping them going. And I will say it, and since people say this in Farsi, I know people may not, first of all, they may be surprised to hear it in English, and of course our leaders here may not like to hear that, but I will say it frankly, is that they also provide an enemy for the West. And if you have, if in the West you have something called the military-industrial complex, right, you do need enemies, you know, to keep the economy going as it is, you know. And so in many ways, they have, at least the allegation is that Western countries as well have kept them going by giving them just enough, you know, a lifeline to just stay on. And this creates a lot of, you know, anger among Iranians, because they see that, you know, just political or self-interest is actually victimizing a lot of people, you know. So I think this was a very long answer to a very short question.
Yeah, but I mean, I appreciate the context, and you know, it's very easy as you know, a white person who's only ever lived in Canada and hasn't traveled to Iran or the Middle East, and you know, it's very easy to think, oh, the morality police, like, okay, they're, you know, going around telling you to do XYZ, but to get that level of sort of geopolitical history into their role and how that plays to the current situation is very useful. So I guess then maybe we can transition to the current situation and how these morality police are back.
Right. Well, okay, yes. Actually, I'm going to say it in my in the rest of my my report of the week.
Yeah.
What happened is that the uprising that happened was basically quieted down. I mean, what can you do? If you go on the street, they just shoot you. And of course, the other important thing that is going on is that what is called the gray caste, the gray color, and caste as a social caste, and this is, I'm translating from Persian, you know, gray caste. This means the majority of middle-class urban people who just don't take any risk, don't do anything, because the uprisings and every strike and everything that we heard about last year was not really a majority of people or even very large numbers of people. These were people who were particularly brave and also motivated, but not a lot of people. And to this day, it still goes on. I mean, they are arresting people for the same thing, hijab on the street. They are raiding people, like yesterday. It was on the news yesterday that, of course, I should mention that this kind of, like, this discontent and disobedience is a lot bigger than before the uprising, because right now even mainstream kind of people, like, you know, TV actors who would be on state TV, you know, people, these are mainstream people there, you know, who are usually non-political or you know, diplomatic with the government. A lot of these people have disobeyed, you know, like women in the TV as celebrities who have taken off their, you know, hijabs in public, and they are getting punished and they are getting arrested. There are news every year, every day about it. And so, like yesterday, a young actor of 30 years old, he's been an actor, you know, a very talented TV actor, I think, or movie actor. And he was sitting on his Instagram and doing a live on his Instagram and quite frankly telling the government that they should go to hell with their hijab, because he was saying, well, look, if my sister, my mother want to dress like that, it's really none of your business, and you cannot force that on anybody. And this is like somebody who has been quite mainstream, you know, so far. And it was caught on his live Instagram. The police raided his house, and what they do is they just bang their door in, you know, and it's very, very scary and very, very disrespectful, of course. And they take these people and they throw them in solitary confinement. And there is really no limits. There is no laws, you know, how many days you can keep somebody in solitary confinement. That by itself is torture, of course, and is a waste of their time. And of course, if they don't behave over there, they beat them. And eventually, a lot of them just die under suspicious, you know, circumstances. So this happened yesterday, and this 30-year-old young man, brave man, is right now in solitary, and we don't know when he's going to come back. So my point is that there is a lot more people who are expressing themselves and taking brave actions, but still the majority of people, you know, you're talking about a country of 85 million people, and like in big cities, there's millions of people that have a normal life, you know, like anybody, they go to work, they come back, and so on. Now, things are much more expensive there, you know, you could have problems paying your rate and so on. But other than that, life is, you know, like middle class anywhere else, you know. And these people, by and large, and you can't blame them. I mean, what do you want? They come and get arrested or get shot on the street. So I think I was talking about the gray caste, you know, as it's called over there. That's why the uprising has quieted down. So I think your question was, where is it going now? Why the morality police came back? Well, after the uprising was quieted down, so the regime is in a new situation. What they did on the international level, they actually went and tried to expand their kind of alliances even within the region. And sadly, Saudi Arabia even, you know, kind of did a rapprochement with them and started back their diplomatic relationships with them on the orders, really, of China, if you can call it orders, at least on the request of China, because China was talking to both of these countries, and China really wants Iran in their orbit, not in the American orbit, right? And so in the region, they kind of mended a lot of their old hostilities, which is hypocrisy, of course, because like Saudi Arabia and Iran are ideological enemies, and they have been enemies very much. And they have really blood in between them, you know. And so the fact that they can come together, which means that they're both the same kind of regime, they're just after their self-interest and no real principles. Even though if you talk to them like 5 years ago, they would talk about, oh, well, that regime is a dictatorship, you know, they don't respect human rights, you know, and ideologically they are not the same kind of Muslim as us, and so on and so forth. So that's what they did on the international level, the regime, after the quieting of the uprisings. So having done that, now they feel more powerful. They want to come back and show that they are in control and the boss, you know, inside the country. So calling back the morality police is really part of that. It's really part of them telling the population nothing has happened, everything is back in order, and you have to, you know, behave. That's what it means. Of course, it doesn't mean that it's over, you know. It doesn't mean that it's over, but at this point, it does look like on the pessimistic side, you know. So that was why actually they're calling back the morality police. On the other hand, what happens on the ground may not be actually what they're claiming. And as I'm going to actually continue in my roundup of the week, even as they were announcing that the morality police is coming back, there were denials from within the government. This is really, you know, like ridiculous. You know, the police, the spokesman for the police force was on TV and announcing it. And another website, which is calls itself a news agency, which is close to the IRGC, the parallel military that they have created, was saying that no, this is not right. Morality is not coming back, morality police. And another thing that the police spokesperson said was that the office of the president had ordered, you know, this reinstatement. Even today, this morning, I heard that on the Iranian media, actually, that a very close a very close, you know, person to the president, who has a job consulting the president on women's issues, was also saying that no, president hasn't given such an order. Now, why this is happening is, you can, you know, interpret it in different ways, but to say the least is that they're not sure themselves, and they don't mind actually fighting together. They have fought, you know, within each within the government for a long time, and it's no secret, you know, there is different factions within the government. And but one aspect of it is that the people that are denying it may want to save themselves for you know, the day when the regime may not be there, because if they're saying this now, if you know, sometime from now the regime has fallen, then they can come out and say, look, we tried to help, you know, we tried to, and so on. So that's another aspect of it.
Okay, let's then get back into into your news roundup. Thank you for all of that context, because I think it's for me, and I'm sure for a lot of listeners, it's very helpful to be able to place what you're about to tell us in that broader historical context, for sure.
Thank you. I tried. Okay, so to continue with my roundup for today, I was talking about the morality police coming back, and the fact that it wasn't as simple as the headline said. You know, it wasn't just like a simple decision that, you know, the president made and sent the morality police back. And this becomes apparent when you look at the Iranian media in the native language. Actually, from Iranian media in diaspora, who de facto played the role of opposition media, we heard that this hadn't been an easy or unanimous decision within the government. Because even as the spokesperson for the police was announcing it on TV, a website close to the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, and this website, which is seen as the media wing of the of this paramilitary army, calls itself a news agency too. So they claim that they're doing professional journalism there. And as I was saying it in answer to your question earlier, this website was saying that no, there will not be the police vans anymore on the streets. Nothing with markings of morality police anymore. But the police spokesman was saying that they had direct instructions from the office of the president to do so. And again, at the same time, some people that worked in the same divisions in the government were denying that they had got any such orders. This is actually quite ridiculous. I mean, it's like as if, like, you in Canada, you had the RCMP saying that they were going to do something, and another police force saying that no, they're not going to do that. And this kind of thing hasn't been uncommon in this regime, as I was saying before. And this time, it does seem like a real disagreement among themselves. Because after what happened, on one hand, they want to save face and show that they are still in control. And on the other hand, this can disgust and drive more people to more disobedience that can get out of their hand. So this is another thing completely different. It's about environments, and it's about, you know, ordinary people in the traditional villages of Iran, which this country used to be more actually rural than urban. It's only in the past 3-4 generations that has become so urban. And my next news item is about what happened to many of those people who are still living in traditional villages. This is an area in the east of the country. It's called Sistan. And so another thing that happened in this area took a very bad situation to worse than ever before. And this situation came with heat. And we know that heat broke records in many places in the world. But in this particular region of Iran, combined with desertification, it has really made thousands of people homeless and desperate. This land historically is a civilization that was formed around Lake Hamun, a sweet water lake that is shared with Afghanistan in the east, that is fed mainly by a river called Hirmand that flows in from Afghanistan. Generally, in the past 35 years, overuse and waste of water resources has caused water bankruptcy all over this country. But this region is an exception in the sense that the blame for drying of the Lake Hamoun mostly goes to Afghanistan. There has been treaties signed between the two countries going back to 1970s to ensure that the river Hirmand always feeds the lake sufficiently for the population on the Iranian side. But Afghanistan has actually taken more water from the river than the treaties have allowed. On the other hand, the Iranian government has basically ignored problems of this region as they have everywhere else in the country. So this was two more paragraphs. And I have the rest of it to the end of the... Okay. I haven't seen any statistics of how many people of this region who were originally in the hundreds of thousands have been displaced to squatter around big cities. But for the ones who have remained, life can mean breathing deadly air in dust storms and dreaming for some clean water. Dryness of Lake Hamoun, combined with the seasonal winds that blow every year and the hotter summer, brought to this region the worst ever dust storms. The particulate matter pollution even reached the big city of 3 million people 800 kilometers to the north and caused the city to shut down. There were some good reports and analysis, by the way, in the media about this region and what happened there during this hottest ever summer of the world. Considering that problems of this region are among the deepest in the country, as well as indicative of the more endemic problems throughout the country, I think we should make a report about it for world media in English.
I think this is a very interesting story, and particularly like a really interesting angle on that story about climate change, because you know, as you said, we've been experiencing record heat everywhere globally, and an interesting thing about this story is that it's, you know, the drought that's happening, the lack of water is, you know, like the people of Iran have, we can say, something to do contributing to climate change, right? But there is this other larger thing that another country is taking more than their fair share of water, and then you can follow that all the way up into a conversation about, you know, like global north and global south,
right,
countries, polities, right, and how it, for a lot of people and a lot of countries, particularly those who are starting to feel the brunt of climate change and really feel the impacts, it's, you know, like it's not any one person's fault, but it's especially not necessarily their fault, right? Like, right. And there's very little they can do through like changing their own behavior to change the situation.
Right. Exactly. That's where the whole, you know, idea of social justice comes in.
Mm-hmm.
By not doing anything, we are really inflicting injustice to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Than just by not doing anything, by taking the life that is given to us, you know, especially the more privileged people, right?
Mm-hmm.
The water that we are given, the electricity, and everything else, it just comes from everybody in the world, you know. And so we do have a responsibility now, a moral responsibility. You can't call it, you know, a legal responsibility. There is no law against it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a moral responsibility. But by taking that responsibility, at least for those that feel that way, you know, you actually feel that you're living a better life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're living a more meaningful life, you know, and you're connecting to other people better, you know, because in the end we all need to connect to other human beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And considering that human beings come in different forms, these people, traditional villages, and I'm going to, like, I saw a very moving clip today about this region. A poor woman, you know, in one of these villages was talking to, you know, through a cameraman, was talking to her member of parliament. And he was telling her, that's in the same region of Iran which I was talking about now. And she was telling him, look, you can take your paper and waste your ink and, you know, that wood in the paper, and you've been doing that for a long time. And here I don't have water. I don't have what gives you that right to do that, you know? That's generally true about all of us, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks, Ramtin, for this second episode of the World Media in English Update. I don't know if I just gave it a title, but I'm excited to be able to